This is Holly Herndon.
I'm Matt Dryhurst.
And you're listening to Interdependence. To this, you're listening to the free version. This podcast is completely ad-free and only possible through listener support. That sounds like a standard line, but it's true. It takes time and care to put this together, and without patrons, we won't be able to carve out the time to do this. So if you enjoy this podcast and would like to see it continue, please visit patreon.com/interdependence and subscribe, where you'll get access to our most recent conversations, as well as an archive of full-length past episodes. Thank you for listening.
Hey, Anzi.
Hey, Anzi.
What up?
How's it going?
Yeah, great. Great to be hanging. How y'all doing?
Sweating it out in Berlin.
Yeah, it's insane.
Actually, should we turn the fan off?
Yeah, I'll turn it off while we talk about this one. Yeah, no, it's a crazy heat wave right now. We're drowning in the hot weather. Nobody can handle it. But it's fine. It's causing everyone to like slow down a little bit, which is kind of nice.
Today's the peak. It's supposed to chill out tomorrow. So we're a little bit slow-mo today.
And where are you right now?
I am in Vancouver, British Columbia, where it is a lovely rainy fall day here at the beginning of August. So
that sounds wonderful.
That sounds so blissful. Yeah, we should say it was lovely to hang out with you while we were at TED. See you and have fond memories of having a nice coffee with you and Jess in beautiful Vancouver. I was so struck by Vancouver, I do have to say.
It's
it was really
stunning.
Fucking, oh, excuse me. It was really cool. Oh, I can't swear on my own podcast.
Well, my mom's always like, hey, she hates it when you swear.
I wish Matt would swear.
But I also got to work with the lovely Anna, who is part of Meta Label, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
Okay, so for those who don't know, would you mind giving a brief introduction to yourself, please?
Yeah. So my name is Yancey Strickler. I have a background working on quite a few different projects. My career began as a music critic. My first gig was reviewing records for Pitchfork and then writing for the Village Voice and Spin Magazine. I started a digital-only record label back in the day. And then I co-founded Kickstarter along with Perry Chin and Charles Adler. That started in 2005, and I spent the next 12 years of my life dedicated to Kickstarter. And then the past few years, I've been focused on a few different projects, writing a book called This Could Be Our Future, A Manifesto for a More Generous World, starting a project in a community called the Bento Society, which is about a more long-term, less individualistic approach to life in the world. And then for the past year, I've been working on a new project called Meta Label, which is a new structure for creative people to collaborate together. And yeah, I would say like I've just always been a person who is just like hungry to consume culture, to appreciate and experience art, to learn about things. And I've been fortunate throughout my career that my curiosity has turned into employment and projects that I've been able to support myself with. And just have been, just been lucky to keep on being able to keep on being curious. And through that meeting great people like you and great collaborators, and feel very lucky to be where I am in life right now.
Very cool. Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of parallels in our thinking, so it's going to be exciting to get into some of this. But you're also a published author. You wrote a book, This Could Be Our Future, right? When was that one? When was that published?
Yeah, that was published 2019. I wrote that in 2017, 2018. And that book is about, it was, you know, in leading Kickstarter, when we first started Kickstarter, I had this extreme imposter syndrome of like, who are we to be starting a business? Like, I had no desire to be an entrepreneur. None of us did. Hmm. But we were just really compelled by the concept that people later came to call crowdfunding. But the notion that like, there are way more good projects in the world than there is money to support them because money's always looking for financial upside. But like 99% of creative projects, financial upside is like gravy. Really, you're just trying to make the idea in your head real in the world and have other people see it. And just felt like the actual motivations for making creative work were just not a part of the funding ecosystem. And so in running Kickstarter, you know, we always sort of held more to these creative values, and we made the company a public benefit corporation because we didn't want to have to be held to this idea of shareholder profit maximization as our goal. And leaving that experience, I just wanted to better understand, like, what was the context we were existing in? How is it that our value system has been pegged so to such a high degree to financial value? What is the history of this? And so spent a couple of years researching a lot of economic and philosophical history and trying to put sort of my experience, the things I learned into context. And really that whole book is an argument that our notion of value is far smaller than the actual spectrum of value, and that currently all values are expected to filter down through money in the end, but like there's just all kinds of perverse incentives and side effects of this. And so it's a book that ultimately argues for a wider spectrum of value, for allowing communities or certain goods or experiences to be valued according to whatever native values they actually hold and not just some external source of value. And really that kind of like led me into the blockchain world as one of the places where it was quite practically true that you could define in numerical terms values that weren't financial. You could determine loyalty. You could make other measurements central to decision making rather than just which one would make the most money. But anyway, that book is just sort of like just exploring that space of, you know, perhaps we're going to look back as this 60 years of extreme financial maximization as this weird aberration in human history, and perhaps now we are stepping into a world with a more expansive view of what value is, and maybe the ability to make more resilient communities, you know, make decisions optimizing for social values, other considerations. So that was a project that really kind of like my life has just been on a course. I think that project unknowingly began since, but that was a lot of. Yeah, that was something I was very proud to do and had a lot of fun doing.
Yeah, it's really nice to hear. I mean, it's funny, last night, do you by any chance know Neto Thompson?
I've seen you tweeting about him this week, but I do not know him, no.
Oh, so it's funny. So he just started a company called Art World, and he's a curator and really smart, lovely guy from an independent music background. And I was talking to him last night, and we were having this kind of conversation around, you know, there is a very small group of people. I would definitely consider you part of that group too, who have in a sense kind of a shared history of maybe coming up and, you know, learning to read culture through the value set. I mean, not as if there's one universal value set, but the value sets of independent musical culture. And we talked a little bit about, you know, how in that world, if you go back to, you know, go back 15 years or something, the squeamishness that there can be both around like commerce and around money. And I wonder, I mean, this is jogging back a little bit, but obviously, I mean, Kickstarter is a really big part of the web experiment as far as I see it, right? For the longest time, Kickstarter was, you know, one of the first kind of ideas that I saw come out thinking of different like kind of digital first ways to support artists, right? Like, and that conversation has obviously matured and developed tendrils in all these different directions. But I wonder at the beginning of that, given your background in independent music, you know, like what was it like to actually take the leap to start working in a company space from that? And I wonder on this from like a cultural side, because I think there's very few people who've actually taken that leap. And I think you're probably chief amongst those people who'd be able to speak to that experience and like the upside and downside of it, because it's in a way, it's kind of, it's still for a lot of people seems counterintuitive, but as I was discussing with Neto last night, it seems increasingly like a decision that people are making, and you've been doing this for, you know, well over a decade. So I was curious to pick your brain about that before we talk about crypto stuff.
Yeah. I love that question because I can put myself back in that moment in like 05, 06, 07, as this was starting to become more real. And I kind of felt like kind of a class traitor in a way, where I had always identified so much as a creative person. I'd made a living as a freelance writer. And I ended up like having day jobs inside tech companies that had editorial publications. And in those companies, I discovered that I was actually quite good at strategic thinking and more like quote unquote business stuff. And honestly, I had a hard time with that. Like, I didn't like being good at those things. I didn't want to be, you know, I was still the surly indie employee that's like whatever man to everything. And like, that was my identity. And to like have to become more responsible, or to like think about money in a way that wasn't just dismissive or trying to wish it away, was, it required a degree of like confrontation with myself of like, maybe my past opinions are a little bit childish. Maybe I'm maturing here. Maybe I am betraying who I am. You know, maybe this is a grave mistake. And there was a kind of an emotional step to go from, yeah, I guess being to more of an institutionalist rather than being a, you know, indie everything.
Yeah.
And I kept like looking around for like someone to come by with a clipboard or something to say, okay, like you're checked now. It's fine. Like, you've passed the test. It's all right. Like, I just felt really uncertain. And I think it took, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years to really like, to truly let go of that feeling. But my identification with indie music, with punk rock, with all kinds of different things, was just so strong that it really was like, the first reason not to do Kickstarter was, well, I don't know if I'm the type of person that does something like this. Yeah. And where we came to feel was, actually, people like us should be doing things like this. And we should use our success to try to chart a little bit of a course that says to other people who might feel they don't belong in this world to say, hey, like, there is a way to do this that you can belong. There is a way to do this that adheres to your values. And becoming a PBC was entirely about that. And just wanting to carve a path that says you don't have to be like all the other assholes. Like, you can do these, you can do this in a way that's righteous, that's just, that's about the creativity. It's about artfulness. It's about soul. And it's not just about a financial outcome. You know, but those are things that rhetorically are easy to say. Those are also things that in emotional experience will challenge quite directly, you know, and you ask yourself, am I crazy? Am I wrong? Can someone like me do something like this? So I would say that was like a constant, constant battle. And now doing Meta Label, I can feel my maturation. Like I can feel that I can hold the creative side and the responsible side simultaneously, and I don't see them in conflict. Yeah. But that took a lot of work to get there. And I do think that is that degree of like how our identities are formed and what feel like the most core values. I think those are things that are obviously hard to see externally, but I think for myself and a lot of friends, that those are some of the hardest things early on as you're like stepping into that entrepreneurial space for the first time.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm really glad that you did actually take that leap. I mean, I feel a great amount of respect for the work that you all did. And thinking about it too, how it, in a sense, like the Kickstarter moment and the continuation of Kickstarter in my mind, in some ways was prophetic of a lot of issues that are now coming up around crypto, Web3, whatever people want to call it, in the sense of like, I remember first encountering that service and thinking, huh, okay, this is really interesting. Like, you're chiefly like focused, one, on how to get creative people paid. Number two, in a kind of decentralized way where, you know, different people were able to come forward with their ideas and find funding for them, you know, which was only later kind of an idea not mimicked or kind of echoed in, like, let's say the ICO moment or tokenization moments or any of these kind of utility moments. But also, I think we've been calling it on the podcast the shock of the nude, specifically related to crypto, Web3, blockchain stuff, where, you know, this kind of shock of having commerce kind of be out in the open and be something that people discuss, where, of course, on a public ledger, people can see how much your art sells for, and they can see how much you raised for whatever. And this in creative industries previously being like a very opaque process. Of course, I remember, you know, first encountering Kickstarter and thinking, whoa, like people, there were definitely people in creative fields who were kind of uncomfortable with it because the finances were so upfront, and for good reason, right?
Totally.
But it's just funny to think back to, you know, my first encountering that and thinking about how those dynamics are just actually now kind of like proliferating even more, that feels to be even more of a public conversation about feeling comfortable, you know, mixing what would be well-intentioned creative work, you know, virtuous creative work with an open and candid discussion about money. And I feel like you and the work that you've done has been really, really instrumental for kind of fomenting that. Well, so respect on that. I think
Kickstarter was before Patreon.
Oh yeah.
And I think without Kickstarter, Patreon would not have.
It was like the first, it was like an alien ship landing. When I first encountered it, I was like, oh, whoa, you know, like, oh, okay, this is real. Like, anyway, that was just my comment. There isn't really a question.
Yeah, I think Patreon's origin story was that Jack's partner in Pamplemousse did an early Kickstarter campaign that did really well. And then they were frustrated that there wasn't an ongoing pledge option, which I think is where they ended up expanding that, I love that Mirror and PartyBid and Juicebox have, you know, given crowdfunding like another life in a Web3 context as well. Because I think that you're right, that social shock of having your identity sitting next to a giant dollar scoreboard is challenging, right? It's challenging for a lot of people. However, you know, ultimately, like that is the function of the site. It's like to build the budget, to build the fan base you need to support a work. And you know, if I think it back to like the kind of a big moment in Kickstarter was the Zach Braff moment, where there had already been like Veronica Mars and several more Hollywood projects that had launched, Spike Lee, and then Zach Braff went to fund a film. And the project was going well for about a week. And then like Gawker started tearing him apart for like, man, you know, look at this rich guy. And that ended up like being, you know, a really tough experience for him and a lot of people, even though like all of his fans were excited to be a part of it. Like, they're like, I love that I get to, you know, have a deeper relationship with this person, but yet it was entirely perceived through what sort of access he had outside of this tool, outside of the web. And there's a way in which I can see a connection to that, to the way we're now trying to compute, you know, how these crypto financial values, what they say, what they mean, who's allowed to use them, how can they be used? Like, there's
proximity.
Yeah, there's it's something that I think the discomfort we feel with that is real. And I don't know exactly where to put it, except just to like reflect the honesty of it. And maybe it just, you know, money is just still one of those topics that has enough emotional charge in it that it causes a lot of these emotional reactions. But I do see Kickstarter as being, you know, ultimately I feel like we built a door in this wall where it ended up like everyone really needed that door to be there, but nobody had realized it before. Because when we were going around to investors at the start of Kickstarter, I mean, most investors, VCs we met hated the idea. They're like, we heard lines like, they're starving artists for a reason. And there's already too much art in the world. Like a famous VC said, there's already too much art in the world. Why do you like this? No one wants this. And
wow,
like,
what a horrible person.
Scrooge. Was it Scrooge McDuck that you went to?
And so it was like, it was a tough sell. It was a tough sell, but you know, clearly that has helped to validate the idea that there is a, to use like 15 years ago language, there's a very long tail of creative work and audiences and, you know, an infinite resource of ideas that have value in the eyes of the public. And you know, the ideas individually might not be worth enough money to merit attention from like professional investors, but in the aggregate and as an overall movement, it's a huge cultural reset. And and Kickstarter remains going strong. I mean, it's $6 billion that has gone to creative people wow. through Kickstarter. Last year was their biggest year on record. So it's like, awesome. You know, in the tech world, if you're not 3 years old, you're like invisible. But that continues to be a phenomenal service and community that continues to do great stuff.
Yeah, super interesting. I'm kind of like formulating this question, non-question / straw man in my head that I'm going to try to kind of like barf out here in some way. So I was thinking about, you know, in your book, This Could Be Our Future, you're talking about finding other values that aren't necessarily monetary values, like social capital and community and all these other kind of things. And one of the kind of straw man arguments in the crypto space is that it's trying to over-monetize. Financialize everything. So how do you kind of like square that circle, or what's your kind of take on that?
I mean, I think that the critique of extreme financialization of crypto, I definitely think there's truth to that. I think that the market activity since winter began a couple of months ago shows that speculation was driving most crypto activity. I mean, if you go to Dune Analytics, like everyone's usage charts have just gone off a cliff. So I think there's something to that. However, I also think that there are other kinds of projects and other ways of approaching crypto that point to a different set of values. Like maybe something like a whitelist is an example of maybe a different structure through which to think about how access to goods are distributed. You can look at, the way that, say, Gnosis is working on NFTs, where people can earn certain levels of seniority based on actions they've taken. Or, you know, so there's, I feel like the layers that are being built now and explored now are about what can we measure or identify and also bring into a cause for an exchange? So if someone has been active in the Discord for this amount of time, can they be rewarded? I think things like that, while now are still ultimately resulting in like, we'll airdrop you a token that you can, you know, dump or something. I think long-term, those are going to be more like you've received access to an area of this world where other kinds of things can happen that are right. just as much about social values or who you get to collaborate with as it is how much money you have or how much money you get out of it. And so I think that we are in the early stages of that. And the other part of it that's a little bit different that I think is also happening is that in the past, the extreme focus on financialization was really tied to like an individualistic notion of financial outcomes. Person's expecting to maximize for what they get. And I believe that the world we're moving into is a more post-individualist world where the groups that we belong to are rising in value. And maybe in the future, it's like the financial standing of the groups I'm a member of is actually what's important. And like the financial standing of a social group that you're a part of is, I think, leads to a different set of decisions than perhaps like, how much money am I personally getting? So I view that as being like a totally fair critique of saying, you know, crypto is overly financialized. But I think that the tools and the desire and like the sort of the social evolution of the space is going to increasingly open up other dimensions. And maybe there's still going to be a price tag because these are, in many cases, fungible assets that are created. So maybe that aspect of it doesn't go away, but perhaps the percentage of a dollar value that's made up from like social value and, you know, difficulty to get this because of all the steps you had to go through, maybe those things are going to become like more social and less economic, perhaps. And maybe that leads to like different system design. And so I view this as like, It is a world where you can practically change what the core value is and still have transactions occur. And so I believe that there are unlocks and evolutions here that are possible that I think could point to a fundamentally different kind of future. But, you know, financial power remains incredibly strong. And, you know, one of the complicated things of crypto is it's both like hyper capitalist and quasi socialist at the same time. And there's this tension of like the big VC along with like the regions, to use a Gitcoin term, you know, who are trying to do good in this world. And like, there's this battle, there's this tension between these two forces, as there kind of always is in all aspects of life. Mm-hmm. But I think that the tools that are available on the region side, actually have a bit more of a fair fight than they've had at any point in recent history.
I agree with that.
I think I agree too. Yeah, it's funny. And it's funny to think how, in a sense, interdependent the degens and the regens are, right? Like, and it's a really strange moment, but it's totally true.
If
it weren't for the narratives, and also, to be quite honest,
the energy
and the libidinal drive and the work being done, right? I mean, because it's like, just politically speaking or culturally speaking, you know, like, the Ethereum core developers who are actually putting in a lot of the work that would eventually qualify the pump and dump schemes, you know, that gives them their kind of narrative to piggyback off of. These are the regens, right? These are the people working on long-term infrastructural things. I think you're also right. I mean, I remember you before referring to this post-individualist term. It seems, in a way, ambiently, as kind of a culture person, like stepping back, right? Like, one of the big, let's say, difficulties I had with the Web 2 moment of social was it felt like a kind of unbundling of subcultures, right? Where all of a sudden these kind of discrete subcultural scenes were being invited to, in, you know, being invited to kind of like introduce themselves into this huge pool of the public, right? Where like, I mean, to use a music analogy, right? There was a period of time where you would go onto Pitchfork or something and you would see the Beyonce record now being reviewed next to this smaller, weird record from wherever. And the big opportunity with the YouTubes and Twitters was that it was all a new space for everybody equally, right? So everybody kind of unbundled into the great wide open.
Well, it wasn't equally, but it was presented that way.
Yeah, I agree. It wasn't equally, but that was kind of the pretense. But then, you know, on the side, at least, of like crypto Web 3 that I'm sure we're all interested in, it feels a bit more like that bundling process is happening again, that there were, you know, too many people were exposed to the elements for too long that they began to desire coming together into groups and trying to structure themselves into, you know, into small scenes.
What one could potentially call a meta label.
Exactly. Exactly. We're going to get there. But like, But I agree with the thesis, right? I agree with the thesis that ultimately, again, you know, the great promise of why I found crypto or any of these kind of like, let's say, the Ethereum network more specifically, the most interesting, is just this idea of coordination, right? To go from like the uncoordinated space of the feed or whatnot into a more coordinated environment, which appears to be happening slowly.
Yeah, I totally plus one that. And the way I've come to think of it and the way I got to like this post-individual framing is, this is going to sound like very boomer, but like, I think the internet re-individualized us, because with the web, we could now define our identities, not by where we lived, and not just by what we looked like and not just who we were physically surrounded by. We existed in this new infinite universe. And what we found as we entered that universe is that each interest, all these different aspects of our personalities, those actually can become their own distinct identities online. And actually online, we have this like infinite spectrum of identities based on whatever things we care about, whatever attributes we have, whatever alts we want to build up. And what we are discovering is that like all those alts and identities, many of them have some element of truth in them, and they are like real in some ways about us. And the like complexity of what it is to be a person is something that's quite different. And so like an individualist, so I would say like the last 15 years, 10 years of the web have been highly individualistic. And we see that in like your ultimate goal in any social setting is to get followers, is to get other individuals to follow you as an individual. But the actual emotional experience of getting followers and speaking to followers, we were all discovering, is like quite lonely and quite alienating and creates all sorts of complicated feelings. And it's not actually that pleasurable of an experience. And so I think that the web and a lot of this is like the tools of the web have matured to make this more practically possible. But now we're maturing more towards social value is not an individual follower count. It's in what groups are you in good standing with? What are you a member of? And to me, that is a post-individualist sense of value. If we x-rayed you and saw all the personas you hold, like how aligned are they with other groups? Like what kind of social power do you tap into? What all are you a part of? And I think increasingly that is what is going to drive a lot of social value. That's going to drive what you have access to and what you don't have access to. And I believe that those kinds of post-individualist structures are going to be ways that people get economic power, you know, social power. They get some means of security. And there's a fascinating mirror of this where about 1,000 years ago, there's these two great books, The Invention of the Individual by Larry Seidentop and The Weirdest People in the World by Joseph Heinrich. And both of these books are about where the individual came from as a concept. And really its origins are primarily in Christianity for a lot of different reasons. But both books point to this moment around 1000 AD where some Catholic churches around Italy and France and Germany began to ban cousin marriage for the first time. And the reasons for why they banned are not totally clear, but the end effect was that at that point, most families lived as clans and they had like their own compounds, and clans tended to marry cousins within their family to each other as a way to more centralize their power. And as the church prohibited cousin marriage, gradually what began to happen is young people from these clans had to meet people in other clans. And so suddenly you needed different kinds of social spaces and customs. And both books point to within 100 years of this happening, there were 4 inventions that happened. The city was invented, the university was invented, the guild was invented, and the monastery was invented. And so what the books argue is that once people were liberated to become individuals, they very quickly had to invent new contexts in which they could coordinate and cooperate for reasons other than like blood, other than that they shared the same blood. And so the world like reconfigured around these institutions that were all based on non-blood relations. And now those things have like overtaken the world they come from. If I look at the internet as like a re-individualization moment of all of us, then the first 10 years or so, we're like wandering in the wilderness, trying to find who are we in this world. And now we are discovering, just as people did 1,000 years ago, that we need to create institutions and shared contexts that let us do things. And the challenging thing about the web is that our shared interests are not as simple as just like who we appear to be. It's all these layers of who we are. And so we are creating many layers of societies based around all of our alts, all of these different beliefs. And like, and I believe that we are, that the institutions that will guide society for like centuries to come are probably being formed now. That whatever the city, university, guild, and monastery is of the future, maybe those are group chats, you know, maybe it's a Discord, maybe they are forms that we are creating now as a way to organize, make meaning, do things together. And so I think that we are like in a, just this transition that we are all like, we can feel happening. We don't know where it's going. But if I look at sort of how people have responded in the past to sort of being newly liberated, I think it points to a shift in values that I believe reflects what's happening now. And so I think of that as being a post-individual, where it used to be that like your greatest quest in life was to discover who you were as a person. But now like everyone is born an individual. And now the quest in life is to discover what groups you belong to. There's a great Cahill quote from the Normcore PDF that talks about this. And so I think that is the journey we're on. And that to me is why meta labels are so important. Because if I think, okay, we're moving into a world where we need these like social structures that are based around things we care about or, you know, how we identify. Well, what is the creative structure? What structure is there for a group of creative people who love the same, you know, aesthetic, who believe in the same sound or scene. And I think that there needs to be something there that allows those people to coordinate, to make work together, to share resources, because I think that's where everything is going. And and so, yeah, so I think we're still in the early stages of that transition, but I think that is like the meta transition that's happening behind us.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a really interesting framing. I mean, in a way, those kind of similarities and, I don't know, aesthetic affinities were being traced. They were just being traced by opaque algorithms that were then being used to sell us things. They weren't being traced in a way to like bring people together to create community. So I'm really looking forward to the moment when the penny drops to kind of like a larger scale of artistic community to really understand the kind of the possibilities that Web3 unlocks that Web2 was really kind of keeping under cloak and dagger.
Yeah, totally. I mean, did you ever see that there's years ago, there was a young developer who put together a project called Twitterverse. Did you ever see this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like, for those who didn't, it was basically like mapping social graphs on Twitter and trying to define social graphs based on new archetypes, right? So like you would have archetypes like the new left or rationalists or, you know, degens or crypto people or whatever it would be. And then if you reached a certain point, it showed you where you were on this map. And it was really interesting because it was funny. I think I tweeted something along the lines of like, you know, like a 20th century subculture was, you know, I wear black and I like metal. And then a 21st century subcluster, which is more like, you know, this kind of clustering of different groups, Venn diagrams that you happen to fall into on a social graph, is I fall somewhere in between, like, you know, the left, like more lefty crypto people and, people in the design, like academic design community and people in dance music culture. And like in actuality, you know, it took a young developer to query the Twitter API to kind of expose that. But of course, as Holly said, that was already kind of attempting to happen. It was just that information was only really available to Twitter, right? That was like how you serve ads by pushing people down. And it seems very much like even with, as you mentioned, with whitelists, like the PFP moment or some of these early experiments with crypto are in a way like trying to figure out ways to bind together those groups from Web2 and then bring them into communities elsewhere, right? Because like you can say for some reason, like if I come out and say, you know, an FWB person or a M'lady, right? Like if you're in crypto, that actually makes a difference. Like you actually kind of know a little bit about the person based on that, right?
One of them probably smokes and the other
doesn't. What about both? Exactly.
And then there's both, right? And it's like, so it is kind of funny how it is this kind of, you know, it feels like a perennial maybe process that we're always kind of going through. But I completely agree with you that appears to be the cycle that we're on. Is like there is some kind of desire to find the others and start building stuff together outside of the, you know, the independence economy, which is very exposed, right? It's like you can, dying from exposure on the.
there's a piece I did with Adam Curtis, the documentarian Adam Curtis, about 6 years ago, called "The Dangers of Self-Expression," and this this conversation is really what kicked off post-individualism, and it's a topic he and I've talked about a lot. But he talked about how like basically we have all been tricked into seeing ourselves as individuals. We have been like taught to see ourselves that way. And that, but of course, to be an individual is to be powerless compared to what it is to be a member of a group. And uses this great analogy of imagining go out into the darkness at night and like you on your own with one flashlight versus you walking out with 50 other people. Like think about how much more powerful you are. But he said the irony of all ironies is that it's only the computers and their algorithms that actually see all the similarities that we share, right? It is exactly that you said. It is a developer finding these connections that can say, actually, all of you are the same. And the crazy thing about Web 2 is who is empowered to see that? Advertisers.
Exactly.
Right? Not people. We can't see. I mean, we see in like, you know, who you recommend to follow, but like, as a practical tool, as like as a means of knowledge, like it's nowhere, but yet, computers, which we think of as being you know, maybe enemies of social alignment in some way. It's like they can better see these things that we share. So it's a, yeah, that piece by him is exceptional. And it really points to just the ultimate limitations of individualism, but also the challenges of moving beyond it, because to ask someone to give up their individuality is like terrifying. You know, that's like what cults do. Like, you know, it's like not something we're supposed to do, but there is a degree of evolving beyond your individuality. That's something a little bit different that I believe is happening more and more now.
And speaks to a base human need, right? Did you ever read the Robert Putnam book, Bowling Alone?
Sure. Yeah. And he had a great sequel last year called The Upswing, which is also super interesting.
Oh, I missed that. What was The Upswing about?
The Upswing shows that it is the history of America between 1850 and today. And it basically shows that there have been two major swings between individualism and collectivism. The first happened in the 1870s and 1880s, where industrialization and the robber barons and the growth of extreme wealth inequality provoked a huge growth in individualism. And there was like a moment of like culture becoming more individualistic. And then there became this counter push of like, we should reclaim the public space. And in the book, he talks about within a 20-year span, the Boy Scouts, the Audubon Society, the Parent Teacher Association, the NAACP, like the Red Cross, every major social institution of the West, basically of North America, was invented during a 20-year span. And it all came during this moment of like, we need to push back against this individualism. So he tracks that as like that growth of collectivism beginning in like 1880 and culminating in the 1950s. And in the 1960s, you have the baby boomer generation rejecting that as being conformity and the, you know, Marcuse one-dimensional man and all of these things. Yeah, and that became this rise of individualism that we are, you know, my feeling is that that like crested and peaked maybe 5 years ago. And now we're swinging another way. But yeah, it's a great book. It's quite convincing.
Well, I feel like this is a perfect segue, preamble for discussing actually what a meta label is. Would you mind going into it a little bit? Because I feel like in advance of maybe discussing what the organization is kind of set up to do, it's really fun to.
It's a concept and a company.
It's a company.
Concept.
We'll cut that bit out.
Yeah. There's definitely some hall of mirrors there. So, very very simply. A meta label is a release club where groups of people who share the same interests put out work together. So you could think of a meta label as being equivalent to like an indie rock label, or any kind of indie label, not just indie rock, any kind of indie label where someone, you're Calvin Johnson, you really love the Pacific Northwest, you put out your own music, and then you decide, you know, I want to represent other people from my same scene. And eventually you grow your individual practice into like a larger community of people who are all releasing work and kind of like standing for the same values and manifesting your collective beliefs in the wider world. The record label structure is like nobody's favorite thing these days. I think that's because when you get to major labels and even the bigger indies, they have been relentlessly optimized according to financial capital desires. And so this is why they're extractive and a barrier between an artist and an audience. So a meta label is more like a hard fork of the indie label model, you know, in their structure, in their spirit, in their intent. They're like a homegrown indie label started by an artist or group of artists who are passionate about a sound, a scene, a place, something like that. And so basically a meta label then is a tool for coordination of those people. So the way it practically works is that a meta label is a group would create their identity. You know, here we're four people who all care about, Vancouver hardcore. So we create a meta label around all things related to Vancouver hardcore. And then together we began to put out releases. In our world of meta label, a release is not just a record or a song or whatever, it could be that, but a release is absolutely anything cultural. It could be a meme, a video, a blog post, an NFT, whatever it is that you might make that is intending to further whatever your aesthetic or cultural point of view is. And by releasing that work within the frame of a meta label, you're not doing it just solely by you as an individual. You're having the social support of that group of people behind you. And you're also agreeing to split the economic outcomes of that release with that label. So for each release that a meta label drops, there will be a different contract that will guide, you know, maybe 70% of the money goes to the creators in this case, 30% goes back to label treasury, which we can use to invest in future projects. But it's basically just a very lightweight structure by which groups of people who share the same cultural goals can creatively, economically, and emotionally collaborate and be interdependent on one another. And I first thought of this frame after really hitting a wall of burnout of my own creative practice. And I came to realize I was like trapped in the creator economy and just feeling increasingly unhappy and alone. And I thought about, some of the indie labels that I've always loved that have just like really shaped how I see the world. And I thought about projects like FWB or Mischief, or even a project like the Whole Earth Catalog or like the Royal Society. And these is these like long running collective projects that are constantly releasing new material that is expressing some larger worldview. And I believe that this is like, after having gone deep in this in a lot of different ways, like I've come to believe that this is a recipe for cultural influence, that this actually is how, because like if you're a punk label, every time you put out a punk record, you are in effect manifesting more punkness in the world. You're trying to create a bigger circle for punk and wider culture. You're trying to draw more people into your universe. And these things are way more powerful if it's like multiple voices speaking to the same creative goal, if it's not just the same person. And so this, to me, this is just a recipe, a structure for better outcomes. And so I think that it's something that, you know, I look at, say, the work you all are doing with Channel or a lot of different projects you've done, I think have a lot of elements of this where it's like, we do a lot of things that are maybe all towards the same bigger picture goal, but they're maybe all coming at it from slightly different ways. I think that that is that's the way to do things. And so right now, you know, everybody hates labels. Labels are elitist, they're extractive. Well, that's just because there aren't enough labels, and that's because they aren't like these bottoms up homegrown things, which is what meta labels are and are going to be, where it's like groups of people deciding among themselves what kind of world they want to create and then having an actual structure that allows them to do that.
I'm going to ask kind of an annoying question that I'm sure you probably are asked a lot, but would you say that a meta label is a kind of subcategory of DAO, or would you say it's kind of like a DAO is maybe like a more nascent form and it kind of is the baby and then it grows up to be a meta label?
Yeah, I see them as, they're definitely related, but I think that they're distinct. I would not make a meta label a baby of a DAO, because I think that the label is a structure.
No, I meant it the other way around. Like the DAO is the baby and it grows up to be the meta label.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, where I would point the difference between a DAO and a meta label is a DAO are people who have come together around some shared social context, but there's no impetus to put out work. To me, the point of a meta label is to create cultural works. The point of a meta label are releases. And I believe that most DAOs will have a meta label, right? And I think a lot of DAOs have, like, we have a treasury, we have a lot of, you know, pent up nascent energy. Where do we go with it? What I think that those DAOs should do is that they should adopt the structure of a meta label. And there's like, we have tooling that shows you, like, you identify your purpose. You identify what rules you want to make for how you operate together. You know, are we egalitarian? Do artists own their work? Like, how do we split money? And then what types of releases do we want to put out? And once you define these parameters, they generate a shape, like a natural organic shape that your work is going to appear as. And so I think the step is for these DAOs that have energy, that have budget, that have shared beliefs. It's for them to come together and say, we should be putting out work that reflects what we believe. And that is really, it's drawing more people to us. It's creating more space for this in culture at large. So they're definitely related. And I would say both are also like, I think I see DAOs as like more smoke than fire. I think they're a sign of this larger post-individual shift of like, we are trying to find what groups we belong to. And we're trying to create structures in which belonging is possible and practical. And so a DAO is like an important step in that journey. But I don't think that like what's important about DAOs are DAOs themselves. It's just this, it's a part of this evolution of us finding more truthful, you know, more internally derived means to come together.
I mean, I love the thesis, and I love the emphasis on it being kind of a productive, creative endeavor. I think a few things come to mind that why I think it's really smart. I mean, we've had conversations between ourselves for a while of all of the things that we would love to contribute to, but in a, let's say, individualist paradigm, wouldn't have the time or the resources or the will in some ways to do alone, right? So you think, for example, I mean, in the name, Meta Label is the label, right? So if we use that analogy, we've discussed in the past, like, what would it look like to release works? You know, we're fortunate enough to be in a position where we could, you know, benefit somebody else by saying, look, this is really crazy music that should be released properly and respectfully. But the efforts to do something like that alone are just so great, right? It's such a great deal of work and time to do that properly and to do it justice, right? But the prospect of saying that there's tooling out there where groups of people who share a shared interest in, I don't know, let's say AI music. I'll bring that up for example, because it's wild to me that in the, you know, the you know, this is a pretty groundbreaking era for sound creation. And in a previous time, you would have labels just dedicated to that, right? And yet we exist in a time now that the economics don't really work out. Like, there hasn't really been a label stepping up to do that. However, I would love to donate hours of my time and perhaps even some funds toward supporting some artists to release work and have them be represented beautifully, right? In order to advocate for what I see as being, and this is my opinion, I see as being a really special moment in music history, right? And so what you're talking about with this tooling unlocks all of that, right? This is this kind of, to use your long tail analogy earlier, right? It's all this work that could be done, all these releases that could be made, but ultimately many of the cultural actors or cultural participants or whatever you might describe them as don't have the time or the coordination tools to do in a way that is feasible or kind of practicable.
Well, this is a nightmare for that. It's going to just mean more art creation.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We also have to apologize for giggling in the background, because since we started talking about this,
there's a saxophonist and a dog barking. I'm wondering if I should shut the window. Can you hear that? The saxophone?
I don't hear it at all. I don't know.
So maybe the mic's not picking it up.
Yeah, the mic won't pick it up, but it's crazy.
It's also because Matt's like going on this like monologue, and then there's this like jazzy saxophone in the background.
Yeah, Bleeding
like,
Gums Murphy is playing in the background. Nice. Anyway, you can pick this up, but yeah, I just love the idea for that reason.
It was possible for people to roll their own, create their own crowdfunding site before Kickstarter existed, and there had been a couple examples of that. Jill Sobule, the band Marillion, there have been a couple one-offs, but extremely high barrier to entry and like not a cultural norm. And similarly, I think that like, finding ways to squat up together, finding ways to release work together is possible now. And there are definitely people who are doing it. We just ran a cohort experience for 39 Meta Labels who are all around the world who are doing it using both Web3 and very traditional means. So it's like, if there is a will, that is absolutely possible. But the difference of something becoming theoretically possible to actually being relatively simple really changes behavior. And so we do want to make it trivial for a group of people to spin up an identity, to manage members, to have a treasury, to drop work, to redirect that work, to fund new projects. And like what I really, you know, we as the team behind MetaLabel have been operating this way for the past year and sort of incrementally putting out releases that express our worldview, that are kind of world building each time. And as we've done that, you know, we've found more and more people that are drawn to the project. We're discovering more about what we're doing. We're building this catalog of work that is ultimately going to represent this world. And, you know, that process has been, you know, very organic, very emergent way of creating and doing things. And it's just something that, like, if I compare the emotional experience of that to where I was as an individual creator a year ago, it's night and day. I mean, for me personally, like, I love to write and create, but I hate to release work. I hate releasing work. You know, creating is like exploring what's possible, just like having fun with my brain and ideas. But releasing is like seeking approval, asking for attention. I'm like my worst 12-year-old self for like seven days after I release something, of just like, could not be more sensitive. And and this is something that within the group of us working together, we've talked about, like, so now as a MetaLabel, before we release anything within our Discord, we talk about how, okay, let's all hold hands now. And we like Discord hold hands, which is just like each of us writing hold hands. And it's just this feeling of like, it is not any of us individually. It is us together. And like, we know from the moment this release is out, it's not just me tweeting about it. It's going to be all of us. It's going to be a wider community. Like, I stand with people with this. Like, I'm a part of something. And it feels different. It feels different. It brings a sense of courage. And then the other wonderful thing it does is it lets, within our MetaLabel, we keep rotating leadership. Like, for a different release, someone else is going to be leading things. We just did this assembly experience that was led by Anna Bulbrook, who's our curator, who like works for TED and has done all kinds of amazing things. And it's like, you know, she's a beast at this. Austin Roby is another squad member. He's a beast at other things. He leads different kinds of projects. And so we each have turns. Yeah, shout out Austin. We each have turns, like being the lead or being the support system. And that to me makes more sense. Rather than every work I author, I have to be like the star of. Like, no. Sometimes I just like, I want to be there for someone I love and care about. And so there's just like a practical structure and outcome of working that I think is more honest. And, you know, it leads to like all of our drops having basically liner notes where we want to list out, here are all the developers who built this. Like, here's who made artwork. Here's who we were inspired by. And just like a different way of thinking about crediting people, sharing economic outcomes of work. And so, you know, I think that creative or that emotional part of the experience is significant. And I can't unsee this idea that we're just all trapped in this single player universe in the creator economy, where it's just like, you're only as good as how many followers you have. And what a ridiculous way to look at a human being.
It's such a stupid metric. And I think what you're describing also speaks, I mean, we speak about this a lot on the pod, but like, you know, this idea speaks also to the truth of cultural production in a way that is really important. I mean, I've definitely argued probably a bit too aggressively sometimes that, like, you know, the independent music was named really unfortunately, you know, because of the emphasis on independence, which was in a way kind of like a bureaucratic distinction, right? Like, became conflated with emphasizing the individual, right? Whereas in actuality, as you well know with your experience, and as we well know, that, you know, the amount of people that it takes to put together an ambitious cultural gesture has always been a group effort. And, you know, it's indivisible in some ways. Of course, there are always stars that emerge, but when you look back to the legacy of independent music, right, like, I don't think that, you know, I don't think that the stars and the icons that emerge from the independent musical moments of the 20th century really happen without these kind of coordination monsters underneath, right? Without without just the simple gesture of coordinating to begin with, which is why independent music was a distinct field. And mm-hmm. so in a way, what you're describing here speaks more to the truth of how cultural production ends up happening, and making that legible and voluntary in the ways in which you're describing of, you know, the potential of being a member that can wear different hats in different groups. It's such a more hopeful and in my mind, just sensical, truthful, way to approach these things. And also the other side too is, you know, I mean, it makes me think a little bit. I mean, we're talking about like identity formation, and so many people, you know, prior to the Web 2 moment of everything turning, like everything resolving into one or two feeds that everyone looked at, like the truth of the internet was also, you know, now it might be the PFP, but it used to be the forum you were a part of, right? It was like, there's the IDM forum. There's the, you know, the people who are into like synthesizers forum. There were very, very robust geographical based forums. I vividly remember going to shows when I was like a student in the UK, and like you go to Leeds and then you try and find the Leeds forum.
Yeah, but do you remember what killed that? A lot of it.
Facebook.
MySpace
and Facebook.
Because I remember we went to Mexico City one time, and we were like, there's this cool punk market. I can't remember what it's called, but all these kids show up with their like homemade punk gear and merch, and it's really cool. And so we were like looking back at the kind of like blog days and even like Witch House stuff, and like people were writing different blogs on different shows that were coming through through town. And then Facebook was released, and then everything kind of migrated over to Facebook, and it completely changed the dynamic.
It was like the pros and cons of the kind of it's the great unbundling of like the kind of globalizing moment of culture, right? Where there were pros and cons to it, but that was exactly it. You would go back and you would see, I would look for like straight edge hardcore or something in Mexico City, because I was like interested in finding those bands. And you would see a bunch of posts with forum links and local shows and local flyers. And there would be a blog spot or something that these were posted on to document it. And then the second to last post was always, come see us on Facebook. Or come see us on MySpace. And that was it. It went from being these groups to all of a sudden there. And then speaking to people locally, they were like, oh yeah, well, that was the point whereby, you know, shows dried up a little bit, and all of a sudden on a weekend we would go see the American band.
Right.
We wouldn't see the local band, we would go see the American band, because through Facebook and these networks, like bigger acts could travel and had like this social mobility in a way that they hadn't had before. But thinking back to forum culture too, it's like, I'm imagining kind of the most strong and resilient components of that, whether they be geographical based or interest based, combined with coordination tools to actually be more productive than they could be before, right? The idea that you have a shared bank account where you can trust strangers who share that metal label environment with you seems very, very powerful and kind of it's all very exciting.
Yeah. Well, first, shout out Witch House. Shout out Witch House. I put out one of the first Salem singles. So I was like, whoa, Witch House. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. I was up there. I was in that. There's a funny way that like, you know, the meaning of indie has been completely redefined in the last 15 years. Like, as you're saying, Matt, indie used to mean independent label, which just means like it's like a small business, basically. We're not a giant corporation. We're closer to a small business. And so being an indie artist meant you're on an indie label. And then starting in the mid-2000s, and I feel like Kickstarter is probably part of this story too, indie came to mean unattached to anything, right? And I think a lot of this came from like just internet-based values of like there are a lot more unsigned people than there are signed people, and so those people began to call themselves indie, and it just like the social meaning of that changed. But it's just even worth considering that in the past, indie didn't mean you were this sovereign, isolated individual. It meant that you were part of a sort of homegrown scene in which you were a participant. The meaning of that word, I think, is like 1,000% different than what it used to signify.
To the point of it not really meaning that much anymore, right? Like where it's kind of been stretched beyond recognition. But But absolutely. And that's what ends up happening with words. I mean, it's a super legitimate thing, but that's, I also appreciate
as
well.
Is that going to happen to Interdependence and Metalabel?
Eventually.
If we do our jobs right.
Exactly. With any luck. I also appreciate as well. You're also a great spawner of neologisms. In all your writing, there's been a consistent thread. Like, you're really, really good and deliberate about naming exactly what it is you're describing. And I really appreciate that.
It's important. You know, coming to, I don't know, I have nothing interesting to say there. We'll just cut whatever that was going to go. It's going to be some bullshit.
Should we talk more about the kind of like nuts and bolts of Metalabel? Or do we feel like kind of covered that enough? Or, yeah.
Sure. I mean, so, kind of maybe where we are, it'd be an interesting place to start. So we had our first drop back in February when we had this piece called Introducing Metalabels, where we introduced the concept and tried to express it through code, like, and how, and what the metalabel.xyz site looks like, which is like, our first approximation of how this form is expressed. Since then, we've been expanding that world with a series of tools. We just made a Discord bot that lets groups like tweet together. We ran a cohort process. We're about to launch a magazine that will celebrate collaboration, teach people how to be a metalabel, talk to great metalabels past and present about what they do. And then later this fall, we're going to roll out our proper product, and that will allow a group to create their identity, to manage their members, to create a share treasury, and to begin to publish work and decide how the economic outcomes of that work are distributed among each other. And what I want to see, my hope is that, you know, 3 or 4 months later, we're able to see screenshots of people's treasuries showing that with each release they put out, like, their capital base of money that they can use to invest in new releases or to support other artists or to do bigger projects, that is growing. And that basically that this can show itself to be a structure with a long-term viability. And that is, and I think it can ultimately end up creating, like, there's a weird world in which I can imagine this is a product that can bring more capital into creative projects, to where actually the classic label model of, like, I'll pay a set amount in production, I get my money back, you keep ownership of your work, and we split profits after I get paid back. Yeah. Like, that's a structure that actually could make a lot of sense in a world like this, and where, you know, maybe the crypto whales who have been, you know, losing money in these crazy Ponzi's trying to get ridiculous interest rates, you know, maybe putting a little bit of money into a creative project and getting a fairly consistent return back is something that becomes viable, and maybe is another funnel and another means through which creative work is made. So I see this as a form that is really meant to create a long-term viability for these projects. And, you know, we'll see the first of these launching through us later this year. I believe that there are a lot of meta labels in the world around us now, but they're all using homegrown, duct taped, you know, different tools and ways to execute what they do. And, you know, and for us, like, we are, like all these other groups, we want to keep operating as a meta label, making drops, collaborating with others. This Discord bot we did as a collaboration with Trust, who we love. And, you know, and that's like, we want to work with people who see the world the same way we do. We want to, you know, we just want to create a new space in the universe for this kind of work. Yeah. And ultimately, I think every meta label's goal is going to be something similar, but it's just going to be about whatever their universe is. And so, you know, in this most recent assembly cohort we did, we had in there some of the founders of Extinction Rebellion were part of it. Extinction Rebellion very much identifies with the meta label concept. Like, they're a group of people who are drawn to use civil disobedience to change the conversation around the climate. Like, that's a label, right? They create releases of these crazy actions to do that. there's like a music festival in Mexico City. The Normal Festival is a part of this. There's DAOs who are part of this. There's traditional arts nonprofits that are trying to use releases as a way to generate more interest around their work. So I think that this is it's a form and a way of working that's like on the tip of a lot of our tongues. And we'll see how good a job we do at expressing this and of making something that people deem to be valuable. But, you know, we're very inspired by the hyperstructures model. You know, we're building this as a protocol that will be forkable, extendable. We will be the first client, but we hope not the last. From the very beginning, when you create a meta label, you'll be able to have utility on other platforms. You know, we want it to be that if you connect your wallet to Clarity or to Gnosis or Orca, and then someone else in your meta label also connects their wallet, like instantly you have access to all of your data and you can act as a group and move around the web as a group. You know, all of these things are going to be there from the beginning. And yeah, you know, we'll see whether it hits the right cultural moment and whether it connects with people. But the farther I've gone, like I didn't want to start another startup. Like I fought against this idea more than I've tried to make it happen, honestly. But there has been it has pulled us forward. It has pulled us in. Like it just keeps, the universe keeps saying this is something to do. And, you know, I feel like we're trying to listen. But yeah, later this year, it will be even more real for people. And we'll have a universe showing a lot of examples and sort of teaching people how to do this probably by the time this podcast is up.
Awesome. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Hearing you talk about it, there's something that came to mind that I hadn't previously thought about, but I think I agree with. You were talking about the whale wanting to come in and place money in something that maybe produces returns or something. It just occurred to me, I was like, there's not currently, right? Like, some are familiar with, you know, let's say in a traditional label environment or a VC environment or an angel investor environment, the idea of investing in individuals or, you know, a small group of individuals as a company.
Well, you're kind of yield farming, but the people that you're giving the loans to are creative actors, cultural actors.
It's true, but what I'm getting at is there's not really a way to put money into something that you want to see in the world in quite this way, where I'm thinking about mission-driven or mission-driven groups of people where, you know, investing or donating or just simply supporting a meta label concept to me just seems that much more appealing than contributing money to individuals. There's something about that. Maybe I cut this out and
because
this is too vague.
Because it's an investment, you mean, with a return?
Not necessarily because of the investment and return, but more just being like, it's kind of like what I said before, where I'm like, look, there's a publication I would love to see in the world and I would love for it to happen. But seeing a Discord full of 100 people or some kind of a group full of 100 people who are also motivated to make that happen is more confirmational. It gives me more confidence than investing in one individual or another. Maybe this is off topic.
Yeah.
I'm thinking real time.
Yeah, I do think that's true, to where there's a social validation that comes from like a number of people being a part of something. It also, I think that, you know, a lot of meta labels I like to think about, projects like the Royal Society that have run for 500 years, or the Gorilla Girls, or Mischief, or Discord, the label, not the app, that those are... Like if any of those had just been a single proprietor operation, like they wouldn't have lasted. Like people burn out.
Exactly.
You got to hand the baton across. Like an individual is, there's just like a lot of variance. A lot of things can go wrong, but a structure, a collective structure, a transparent collective structure with a history of work that you can easily see, that becomes a very different proposition. And I think that it could become possible to say it's like, you're not putting money in here to get some crazy return. You're getting a return that's just meant to like be better than a treasury bill or something. It's just like a good enough that you're not wasting your time and your money. And I believe that could become possible. I think that would take time, but
yeah,
you know, one of the things I think so much about with this project is like, I believe there needs to be new sources of income for creative people. And those sources of income are largely going to come from, I think, fans who, you know, I used to spend probably $150 a week on CDs and records back when I had no money. And these days I barely spend any, even though like I listen to just as much, right? So like there is a portion of my wallet that is ready to be reserved for cultural collecting of some kind. And I think that this is my desire is to unlock that. And I think that there are ways to do that on both like a individual fan basis, as well as more of like an investor capital basis. And that last part is like, so not my world or what I give a shit about at all. But as you look at something that could become like fairly economically predictable and has some known quantities, then, you know, it begins to have those traits of like, maybe this is something that could have utility and maybe could allow more creative work to exist in the world. And maybe, you know, maybe AI projects can have a greater capital pool and they can do things like make white papers and, you know, make different kinds of data sets and, you know, who knows. But yeah, so I do think there's something there.
Could the creative output be the return itself? Like, could that be enough? Do you even have to have like a percentage interest return? Could just like the fact that this creative output is in the world, maybe that's return enough for something.
Yeah, so, and that's getting, correct. If I were to make my point more succinct, it's like what I was actually trying to say is I don't know if there's been a way to invest in a scene before, right? Like, I don't know if there's been a way to invest in a scene before. And exactly, the return from that, the creative output could absolutely be reward in itself when you're seeing a group of people who need to ingest some money to really make what they're building more real or more, you know, kind of to help boost the presence in the world of that particular thing. It could also be rewarding to have a stake in the byproduct of that scene. But as Yancy was saying, you know, it's like you would set the permissions on that. You would have a meta label. There's probably going to be meta labels that are not interested in that. And there's going to be some that are squarely interested in that. Well, but investing in a scene is a concept that doesn't really exist.
You also move away, and this is maybe like controversial, but you kind of move away from identitarian, like individuals supporting an individual to represent a wider kind of group that you want to signal that you're supporting, you could actually support the group.
Exactly.
Well, maybe a real example of this would be like the Uniswap granting $1 million to Other Internet to do, you know, a year's worth of or however long of explorations around governance, around different governance models. And so, you know, paying for Toby and everyone else there to do that work and to, you know, to remunerate them and to make that work very visible. And I think that is like kind of analogous to this type of thing, to where ultimately, why are you doing that? You're trying to establish cultural norms. You're wanting to collaborate with like very strong voices that you think bring credibility. And so maybe that is an example of that type of thing. But I agree that there is like this, it's the same reason like UBI becomes challenging of like, we're supposed to give everyone like each person money, like what a nightmare. But if it's like, oh, it's a UBI distributed to different groups and then they decide where to distribute it. Like that's how the NEA in the US functions, for example. They don't make grants to individual artists. They do it to local groups who then decide who to give money to because, you know, politically it's been determined that's the only viable way, but those people are more in the know. So in a world where money is flowing to, you know, a quote unquote local meta label, and it's just like, all right, how do you feel best empowered to, you know, create a post-colonial literature on the web and XYZ ways? You know, those are things that I think everyone can have a bit more trust in, and it's less like, you know, hitting all these, I don't know, timelines to unlock your next source of funding, and can be maybe a bit more like a friendly business arrangement. But we'll see. We'll see how those things open up. But there's like a legibility of a scene that I think you're really right to point out, Matt, that does change how we relate to these things. And I think how institutions will relate to different scenes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the trust in the sense of being able to look and say, you know, if all the terms are out in the open and if everybody in the group has agreed to those terms, the kind of the risk profile of putting money or time into something like that changes from, you know, from placing a bet or placing, you know, placing a great deal of responsibility on one individual. It just feels like a very different way of supporting that. Yeah, that I'm becoming more convinced of it the more we talk. You know, not to say I wasn't convinced before. But I'm just being candid. That makes a lot of sense because we haven't really seen that.
So when can people start using these tools? Are things already public, or are you kind of rolling them out?
Yeah, we're rolling them out piece by piece. I would say the first public interaction with this will be in the fall. We'll have private things we'll be testing with people before then, but we're right now building alongside a community of meta labels and creators who we're learning a lot from. But yeah, this fall we're going to have out a protocol, and we'll have out a client where people will be able to directly use these things. And that will, you know, probably have a limited availability to start that will gradually expand. And, you know, and in the meantime, we're creating alignments with other great orgs, you know, like Gnosis or Orca or other people who we just see as similarly looking at a kind of a post-platform, more bottoms-up collective world. And, you know, and I think that space of like where do groups of creative people fit into this future world we're moving into, I think is a real open question. And I'm curious to see if other potential solutions will emerge for this. But to me, this question of, you know, like I want the four people who are writing like some environmental, they're each writing their own individual environmentally focused substacks. And they're all right now competing against each other for subscribers and attention. And like when one of them has a great piece, the other three people are furious. They're like, oh man, I wanted to be the breakout this week. I want those four people to be wooed by the sexiness and the practical realities of being a meta label, where sure, we can each have our own individual practices, but what if we also created a collective vehicle through which we can like hype each other, we can edit each other, we can make larger scale things, we can, you know, actually make an impact on the world rather than just our own individual followings. And, you know, in our first year of meta label, our goal is to just define the people who are already thinking this way. And we've heard from hundreds of groups at this point who all write in with some version of like, I think I'm one of you. You know, I've never known how to describe what I do, but I think I'm a meta label ? You know, can you confirm? And so the first year is just finding those people and learning with them. And then I think the second year it's getting those individual creators who are grinding away in the creator economy, trying to get their followers and subs up. And it's saying to them, you're unhappy. And why not be in fellowship with other people? And why not also support others instead of just being the star? Why not lift up other voices? Like, and I believe that the cultural moment and these larger changes we're going through, I think people are already going to be hungry for that and looking for that. And, you know, we'll have to bear it out with a great product and experience and all those things. But I have confidence with our backgrounds and our team that we're going to be able to do that. But yeah, we'll see. It's quite an unknown quantity, and to like be going out in the world in 2022 and saying, let's look at labels again in a fresh way is like not the plot twist I think anyone was looking for. But when you think about what are effective tools for creative people to collaborate, to be to share incentives, to coordinate together. There aren't a lot of them. And I think that this is a really worthy structure that, like, I would argue literally the Enlightenment happened because of a meta label called the Royal Society and like the work they put out over several hundred years. Like this is a model that has a great track record that just has like some pretty shitty recent examples, but
yeah,
you know, we can overcome that.
Yeah, totally. Coordination is pretty Lindy. And I can also say also from our experience with Channel 2, it's like crewing up with people in that way can also, it's like, it is this very positive sum gesture where you're like, actually, you know, rather than competing with one another, you then find yourself in a scenario where you can coordinate with one another and just bring more to the table. So you don't step on people's toes or you aren't trying to fight over the same patch. In actuality, it kind of invites you to think bigger, you know? And yeah, I think once that's kind of unlocked and you realize like outside of the kind of hamster wheel of the attention economy or whatever, once that's kind of unlocked, all of a sudden the world just looks like a much bigger, brighter place.
just real quickly, it made a strong statement for you all to do Channel with new models, with Trust, with Josh, you know, with Josh, all these people. It like, you know, I felt like you're saying we're a universe, you know, there's some oxygen here that exists between us. And yeah, it says that's said a lot. That's said a lot.
Well, it's the truth of things, you know, and it also takes a degree of confidence in yourself and others, which again is a very trusting gesture, but it feels good, you know, it feels good to not be so like, yeah.
It also helps drive momentum. Like when it's just the two of us, you know, sometimes it can get, you know, to be a lot just to do like to put this thing together. But then when you're kind of in a larger group of people, you can keep each other, you can keep the energy up and keep the momentum going.
Yeah, totally. I do have to ask as well. So we've been talking for quite a while, but I do have to ask before you go, because you're actually a great person to talk to about this and you've written a great piece on this, but taking a bit of a sidestep, you know, there's a lot of concern in the world. Holly touched on this a little bit about financialization, but there are other critiques coming in where I'll go on Twitter or whatever, and for better or worse, crypto has become kind of this crucible it's become a new culture war for better and worse, right? It's become this new kind of dartboard. And being as thoughtful as you are, and as sensitive as you are to a lot of these criticisms, and as kind of, let's say, constructive as you are in terms of like your particular ideas about where you would like to see this go, you know, do you have any, what do you say to people who are really skeptical of this space in terms of quality?
You're listening to the free version of this podcast. If you would like to hear the full version and support this series, please visit patreon.com/interdependence. This podcast is ad-free and only possible through patron support. Thank you.